Welcome to the Inside College Soccer Podcast, bringing together some of the best college soccer-related people to your earbuds, from coaches to players and beyond. So, thank you for tuning in. The Inside College Soccer Podcast is brought to you by Sports Recruiting USA, the college soccer experts. Now, enjoy the show.
Right, everybody, here we go. Taylor, Rachel, how are you guys? Thanks for agreeing to come on. I'm excited. I don't know that we've had any Ivy League coaches on before. I don't think so. We've had some Power Four coaches on and coaches at all different levels. But it's always nice to talk about something different, and the Ivies are a little bit different than all of the other conferences. So thanks for agreeing to come on, guys.
Yeah, thanks so much for having us, Don. We're excited to be a part of this. And, you know, we've followed a lot of episodes on your podcast, so we're super excited.
Yeah, it always surprises me when I go out to events and how many coaches actually listen to the podcast, and it makes me happy because I think that we all have something to learn from each other too. And I love studying from other coaches and learning from other coaches. And I've even had basketball coaches on because I think we all have something in common. And that's, we're trying to help kids navigate life. So
absolutely.
I think it's great. So Rachel, we were talking earlier and you've got a funny little accent that doesn't sound very American to me. Where are you from originally?
Originally from Bristol, which is southwest England. I actually think I've lost my accent a lot, so I think I'm more Americanized than I ever was. Came across to America to study and play, and then kind of been here ever since. I've been back to England a little bit to play professionally. Landed here now, obviously at Dartmouth with Taylor.
It is funny. My son spent 2 years in England. He went, a friend of mine named Scott Juniper, who coaches the women at UC Irvine, went to University of Bath and played for a team called Team Bath. That wasn't a university team, but they were affiliated. They trained on the university grounds, and a lot of the kids went to school there. Anyhow, long story short, when he came over here, we met, and he met my son and said, "Would you like to go over to train with them for 2 weeks before you start college?" And he said, "Sure." And then that turned into 2 years. But yeah, one of the coaches was, I don't know if are you a Rovers or a City fan? Bristol City or Bristol Rovers?
Yeah, I'm Bristol Rovers.
Oh, that's good. Oh yeah. Well, one of the coaches was Andy Tilson.
Yes, I know the name.
Who was Rovers captain for 3 years, like 93 to 96 or something.
Yeah.
But kind of a legend. He took us to a game, and it's kind of fun when you walk into a stadium with a guy like that. It's like, it took us 30 minutes to get to our seats.
I bet.
Everybody stopping them. And beautiful little town, great area, Bath, Bristol, kind of all pretty close to each other. So
I actually went to high school in Bath. So I also know Bath pretty well as well.
Yeah, it was quite an experience, and I thought it was interesting. And the funny thing is, at least on the men's side, the model that many coaches are putting out is a very similar model to what Team Bath had. I'd say about half the students took classes at university. They trained on university campus.
Yep.
They worked training sessions kind of around university schedules. And, but they played in the pro league. They were in the Southern Prem when he left. So
yeah, that's
for those
probably,
that don't know, that's sixth division, I think, seventh division.
Yeah. It's probably the most similar, I'd say, like Bath University and Team Bath is probably the most similar you're going to get to what the collegiate system is out in America. It's quite rare for that to exist, I feel like, in England, which is why so many English people come out to study and play out in the US.
Well, it was funny because that year, his second year there, they made every one of the players on Team Bath, they made him play at least two games for the University of Bath, and they ended up winning what was called then the BUSA, the British University Schools Association. They named it different now, but they won the national championship because they loaded it up every week with one or two of the players from Team Bath, which was a much higher level. And I was shocked at how poor the level was of university soccer. The guys and I went and watched the Bath University girls train, and it was bad. It was recreational level, bad.
That is
And so
correct.
people wonder, why do British kids or Scottish kids or why do any European kids, why do they want to come here to the United States to play? And the answer is there are no opportunities to go to school and to play like we have in America. It's just not the same. It's more like
No.
club soccer.
Yeah, it's definitely a social thing. And so you get people that maybe have like never kicked a ball before playing on what is the university team. And so the standards, like if you're, looking to play pro and that's your next steps, like that is a big drop off when, you're playing for your university team.
Yeah, so I mean, because I know it's more on the men's side, I would say I get kickback because the women's side, I think the latest NCAA numbers are like 16%, 17% of the rosters in the NCAA are comprised of international players. But on the men's side, we're pr approaching 40% now. Just 5 years ago, 8 years ago, we were at about 25%. So we're seeing a significant growth rate in it. I think it'll slow down with the 5-5, honestly, because we won't get, 23-year-old freshmen anymore. So if they're going to be 23, 24, they're going to have 1 year of opportunities. They've gotten rid of the gap years. So I think that'll help. I'll slow it down a little bit, but the outcry from the average American parent is pretty, it's pretty loud. They don't like it.
No, they definitely don't. But as you kind of said, like it's especially in England in particular, and in Scotland's kind of the same. Like there isn't really a pathway for you to be able to do your studies and play at a high level, and so it's a great opportunity.
And the other, I'll tell you what, the other myth that I hear is they're all coming over on full rides. And I would say maybe 10% are coming over on full rides. In fact, I would say the majority are full pay students. They're not coming in on any financial aid. Firstly, secondly, great majority of these players are coming into universities that Americans want no part of. They're not on any Americans list. I mean, that junior college in Alaska that has 20 internationals has 20 internationals because not a single American wanted to play on that team, and the coach can't recruit a team. But an international player says, "Oh, I'm in the United States." They don't know South Dakota from North Dakota, from Iowa to, I found with all of the players that I've brought internationally, they know New York, they know Florida, they know the Texas accent, and they know California from watching Baywatch or something. That's
Yeah,
all they
that's
know.
true.
And they don't
I'll
know
speak of
any other states.
from me. Like I played in Chicago at DePaul Big East school, and I was like, I don't even know where Chicago is. And which now thinking about it, that's like a little bit crazy. But you're right. It's like Florida, California, New York. Like that's kind of where we know. So yeah, like you said, they end up in places that actually a lot of Americans don't want to go to.
Yeah, but it's no different than the other. I think the average American, at least before Ted Lasso maybe, or before Ryan Reynolds bought
Wrexham.
Wrexham. They didn't know where Wales was, and they don't have
Yeah,
any idea
yeah.
where the Midlands are, or where Leeds is, or where Bath is that we've mentioned, or the average American has no idea either. So I don't think it's any different.
Yeah.
So how'd you end up coming over here?
Honestly, like I knew I wanted to continue playing. I always wanted to play professionally as well. And like we kind of spoke about, like there isn't really a realistic pathway for any English person to do that in the UK. And so I had a couple of friends that I had played with that had come out kind of a couple of years prior to myself. And so I knew about it and, bend it like Beckham and all of that stuff, like educates you a little bit on it. And so I previously played at Arsenal prior to coming out to the States. And one of my best friends actually went out to DePaul the year before me. We are coaches. So my coach in the US was connected to Emma Hayes, who was my coach at Arsenal. And so we kind of got connected that way. She came out to watch us train. And I talked to a couple of different other schools as well, where I knew people at the school. And yeah, that's kind of how it came about. And I was like, this is a great opportunity. Like I knew that women's soccer was like back then, it wasn't going to necessarily pay the bills when you're a professional. So I knew I had to have something to fall back on. And have a degree in education. So like for me it was like the best thing to do for my career. Like I could go and get a 4-year degree, have an incredible Division One experience, and then still go and play professionally after, and then also have my education to fall back on as well.
I tell you, that's something that most people don't realize. And this is not just the women's side, by the way, folks. This is the men's side too. To make a living, and that means I can pay all of my bills and I can save some money for my future, right? I can have a career where this is all I do, play football. For those that are quote unquote professionals of that group, it's a very small percentage anywhere in the world, in any country, that can actually say, I don't have to worry about money after I retire from my footballing career. They don't understand, even on the men's side. I coached pro on the men's side for a period of time, but it was still five guys living in a three-bedroom apartment, and all had side jobs and all had to work during the summer and or in the winter, sorry, in our off season at that time. And it's really, really hard. So that education piece, it's the smart players that understand that I probably should have a plan B. I should have a backup.
Yeah, and honestly, it's like alongside that, it's like the experience you get at like college as well, like from meeting new people, from just how competitive that college soccer is. Like there's nothing like it, honestly, in the world. Like it's the facilities you have access to, like they're at the level of many pro clubs all over the world. So I just think it's like it's the best thing that anybody could do for their next step, in marrying both their education and their soccer experience.
Well, and here's the other thing, Rachel, that I think a lot of people that decry internationals coming over and taking spots. Look, the one thing that we all understand in America, everybody says it, is that we need to get better as a footballing nation, right? It's at best our fifth sport. Some, depending on the stats you see, it might be our seventh sport, but it's definitely not in our top four. And if we want soccer to grow in this country, one of the things that I noticed happening when I brought over international men and women to come play for me is they infected the minds of our American players with a footballing mentality. In other words, I had women asking, hey, can we train early this day because the Champions League is on and we want to all watch it in the afternoon. Maybe you could put it on the big screen in that room for us and we could all watch it together. Before that, my American women had no desire to watch anything football. When our Ghanaian girl was, in the World Cup, playing in the World Cup, we arranged training time so that we could watch her play in the World Cup. And that was not something that was happening before that. So all of those women, and on it happened on our men's side too, that were around players that had grown up in a footballing culture, like this is what we do, this is who we are. It affected our Americans in a positive way. I think it made them better players. It made them appreciate the game more. And that'll carry on to their kids and to their kids. And it'll take a few generations, but as a coach, I sincerely appreciated my international coaches that I brought in and my international players that I brought in. And it made us better people. And it definitely made us better coaches and it made our players better footballers. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think like that's one of the biggest things that I noticed like coming over as a player, like on my TV all throughout the week back in England, like we're watching football, like we're going to games, like it, like you said, it's very much ingrained in our culture. Like I've watched it since I was probably 5 years old. I've been a Man United fan since I was 5 years old. I go to watch their games and all the things. And so I found that like when I came over, I was like, well, when's the Premier League on? Like, how do we watch it? And I remember back then, like it actually wasn't that easy to access. And now
True.
it's available a lot easier. And it does rub off on other people. Like we actually had two English players on our team at DePaul, and we'd be like, oh, who's coming over? Like we're making breakfast and we're watching Premier League, And so that, I think that rubs off on your teammates. And it is like, it's such an underrated part of a player's game is actually watching it. I think so many people think that like, you got to get better technically and that's on the field and you got to get fitter and all the things. But like, you also can grow so much as a player and develop so much as a player just by watching the game. I think even from now being a coach to where I was as a player, like I watch the game totally differently. Like I'm not just watching it to like enjoy it. You're totally different. You analyze everything. And so I think like that allowing your players on your team to grow that side of their game is really important as well. And it's something that we're doing at Dartmouth. Like we're bringing in a few internationals, and I do think that is rubbing off on our team as well to just continue to watch the game so that they can grow tactically and have a better soccer IQ as well.
Yeah, it's all of that. But it's also the cultural integration. I mean, what is university for? What's college for if it's not to grow as a person and to learn about things that you don't know now? And the silliest little things. I mean, we didn't know what cherry Bakewells were, before. And all of a sudden my wife's making cherry Bakewells for the kids, she's trying to figure it out, trying to make them feel at home, but they're infecting our kids. And then in summertime we had our kids traveling overseas to go visit their friends and spend time with their families, and we had their families coming over here and then spending time with our kids, with the American kids. And if there's any way that we can start to break down cultural and racial and divides. I mean, one of the ways to do it is to get to know other people and to understand that, look, we all want the same things. We all want healthy, happy families, and we all want to be happy. And it's so crazy that in a world where we all can't stand each other, it seems like if you pay any attention to social media, sports is one of the things that is transcendent. Music, sports, they're it's transcendent across cultures, and it brings a great value to to our kids that are in college, helps them grow.
It does. Like I think about like that similar situation. Our friends came to visit us in London and Bristol, and you know, like that was one of the few times that they've been out the country. And you know, I just think it provides a lot of opportunity for just cultures to blend and to mesh and to see different things, which again is part of the whole experience and just growing as well. And likewise, you know, for myself, like being at Thanksgivings and all of those things, and you know, the Super Bowl, all the little things that like Americans are all about, like it's great for internationals to also experience that as well, like culturally.
Yeah, I
And I
mean,
think
even when they
we
come back home, right? They infect their families. Were you gonna say something, Taylor?
Yeah, I was gonna say, like, it's funny now, like I think about that influence in our locker room too. Like we have really we've made sort of progress in diversifying our roster from people, players from different walks of life, different parts of the world, and to look around the locker room and see like this group of 28 players that's come together and that love each other, you know, deeply. But you would have met like this group would have come together if it they wouldn't have otherwise if it weren't for college soccer, and to see them like it's like we have a player from Ghana, we have a player from Sweden, a player from England, you know, players from all different parts of the US. So it's really just fun to see it all come together and just, you know, watch that unity sort of happen.
Yeah, and you know, some people understand it. I mean, one of our jobs as coaches is to win. That is one of our jobs. I mean, it's not our only job. It's not the only reason we do it. I mean, I'm sure you guys gotten in coaching, sorry, for the same reasons that I did. I saw it as a ministry. I mean, I wanted to affect these kids' lives and help them. But once you get into it, you understand that, look, winning is part of it. And if you bring in a team of all ECNL players who have all trained the same way, they all kind of look alike. And when you go to ECNL events, yeah, you see better teams than other teams, but you don't often see that many varying styles of play. You often see very similar lineups. You see very similar systems. There's not a ton of variation that at least that I see when I go to ECNL or MLS Next events, or you know, even on the boys' side, ECNL or the GA, even, you know, very similar. But when you bring in internationals, they bring in a different style of playing often, you know, and they bring in different skill sets and different ideas. I've changed the way that I did corner kicks because defended them because of an idea that my Norwegian brought out. And it was something he had learned through one of the pro clubs that he was training with. And you didn't even see it very much on TV. And now you see it a lot in pros. And it was just simply the concept of how you defend the front post. We always had players on the front post. And he said, look, if you take them off the front post by 2 or 3 feet, the goalkeeper has a better view, and they can always step into that front post very quickly if you need them to defend, but it allows them to defend more space. And I thought, how in all my years in my all through my A license and coaching pro, had I never thought about that before? And you watch the pros now, and that's pretty much how they defend corners. And I thought, man, here's this 18, 19-year-old kid coming over from another country, bringing in ideas that are affecting us, you know, and helping us win. And yeah, it's pretty cool.
Yeah, I remember like one of my first sessions at DePaul. It's just a totally different game. I remember feeling like a headless chicken. I'm sure my coach would probably say I was running around like a headless chicken, but the game is so different. And so I also felt like it was going to benefit my game to learn that side of things as well. And you know, the transition side of things is obviously a big thing in the US, and the game is a lot slower, and you know, we keep the ball a little bit more in England. And so I actually saw it as like a really positive thing to like add those layers to my game as well. Like again, I was always looking to be a pro and go and play professionally. So like why not make my game better? Like I'd already been in England for 17, 18 years, like let's add another layer to a la layer to it as well from the US side of things and get fitter, get faster, like, you know, be better in transition. And that's exactly what it did. But I agree, like it allows you to also reap the benefits of maybe those players that are a little bit more technical, like that's what the game has been focused on, and add those layers to what you're building in your team as well.
You guys, one of the things that I wanted to talk about a little bit was the differences between the Ivies and some of the other maybe high-end academic schools. Look, we get lists. The first thing that we ask our clients is, give us a list of what you think that you're trying to accomplish. Like, what schools do you think you're targeting? And it usually varies by not much. It's anywhere from, it depends where the students are from, but it's anywhere from, Johns Hopkins and, University of Chicago, or it's Dartmouth, or it's Yale, or it's one of the Ivies, Princeton, or it's Notre Dame, or it's one of the big soccer schools, Florida State. It's big names, or it's U.S. News and World Report top academic schools by some topic. That's what it is. So they're using AI, or they're Googling, they're pulling off of lists. These are the best schools to go to, and they're saying, well, that's where I want to go. And it's great if you have the ability to. I always say, well, it starts with your soccer ability. So, if you don't have the ability to compete at that level, which many people don't know, they don't know. I'm sure you get a lot of applicants to your team that have never seen a Dartmouth game or never seen an Ivy League game, and they say they want to play in the Ivy Leagues. So it's hard to know. Fair enough. But I guess where I'm going with the question is, since you guys have coached it and played at so many different levels, from mid majors, I would consider DePaul to be, a mid major, to Big Ten schools. You played at Penn State, Taylor, and you've been
Yes.
in the ACC as a coach, and you've also been at mid majors. What would you say the top three major differences between those types of schools and an Ivy League school, if somebody's got an Ivy League school on their list of, that's where I want to play?
Yeah, I think one of the biggest misconceptions or assumptions that we are constantly trying to break down, you know, when we speak with recruits and families, is that you can't let, like, you can't be in a top tier soccer environment at a place like Dartmouth. And I can tell you, like, just based on, you know, you've heard about Rachel's background and my background, like, we were at Dartmouth because we feel that we can develop a top tier program. Obviously, you know, from there are going to be, you know, challenges that exist just like there are everywhere, but we do, like you said, like we're on prospects lists because we have this global outreach because of the academics. And I think it's really, you know, unique, especially in this new landscape in 2026, where you can actually package athletics and academics at the highest level in both ways, where one doesn't have to sort of sacrifice at the expense of the other. And I think, you know, to, like our big pitch, our big sell is that it's academics alongside athletics. So like, you know, we talk to families and we're like, yeah, we're gonna care up, like you're coming to Dartmouth because you care about school, but like we want you to come here and because you care about football as well. And like we don't want it to be this and then that. It's like these two things work together. And I think that's probably one of the biggest misconceptions that we're constantly trying to break down, even though the Ivy League conference over the last 5 to 7 years has been, you know, a renowned soccer conference. Like my first year in the league, as head coach in 23, we were a four bid league in the NCAA tournament. Like we had, you know, we were a top five RPI conference. We're always sitting right in between that 4 and 7 spot in the RPI. So it's like, you know, you can come here and you can, it's a pathway to be a pro. Like you can do all of those things. You just don't have to, you can also do it while pursuing this really prestigious degree.
Yeah, so what I'm going to throw out some of the ideas and thoughts that I hear quite often, and I'd like you guys to kind of walk us through it. I often hear that the Ivies and the Little Ivies, you know, the NUMAC and the NESCAC schools, you know, the high-end academic schools, the U.S. News and World Report academic top schools. They can't even begin to tell you that they want you as a player till they see your junior year transcripts.
Rach, you want to talk about that? I think that is not true. I think that recruiting has evolved a ton. And I think we are very much staying present with all the other Division I programs. You know, I think about 2027, we had two verbal commits on June 16th, I think it was. So, you know, like we don't have to wait for that information. I think obviously we have to have an idea of the academic background, right? And you know, there is a factor with that. They have to be in a good place academically. They have to be taking challenging classes. And of course we want to see transcripts and all the things, but it actually helps us then guide them through their high school academic kind of goals, you know, in terms of what classes they should be taking, you know, helping, you know, in terms of navigating them with their SAT and ACT and all of those things, like actually taking it early so that they can get the necessary scores needed to come to our institution. So yeah, I think, you know, I think our timeline is very similar to everybody else's. We've had that a couple of times. I think just talking to the 28s recently, and that like, yeah, we've heard you move a little bit slower, and you know, I don't think that's the case at all. You know, Taylor, what was it that the Ivy League right now for 2028s had the most of any outside of Power Four commits?
Of any like out, yeah, mid-major conference, Ivy League has the most commits right now for 28.
So, you know, I think we also make sure that we, you know, connect with club coaches. We do our homework on the players that we're interested in. So, you know, once it gets to the point of June 15th and being able to talk to them, like we have a really good gauge of, you know, where they're at from an academic standpoint. And then also like their interest level, whether Ivy League is a pathway and all of the things.
And I think what I would add about that too is like you look at all of these fast commitments that happen, like every verbal commitment that's made is contingent, right? And I think our contingency is just emphasis, like there's just the academic emphasis, excuse me, on our contingency versus anyone else. Like you're seeing kids commit and be decommitted and flip programs and all the things. So like none of this is binding until, and it's a shame, right? Like it's the way that the landscape has evolved, but we're able to gauge where prospects are academically. You know, we've done our homework in this process so many times that it's like, yeah, we can look at course schedules. You know, are they taking challenging classes? How are they doing in those classes? We're telling families now, like, test early and test often. Like I think those are, you know, we are an SAT required school or ACT, either one. So it's better to have a data point than not. So we're telling families like, yeah, like, you know, when we do like college recruiting talks at clinics, we're like, yeah, test in your sophomore year. That's going to give you a better, it's going to give you a better idea of where you stand from an academic standpoint. If you do want to pursue an Ivy environment, then that's something that you've got to tick off earlier than you probably would have anticipated if you want to, you know, be available to Ivies kind of earlier in the process around the June 15th date. Because, you know, what we've all learned is that this process isn't going to slow down for any institution or So we've got to be prepared to move through and put together the strongest classes that we can athletically and academically. So we're coaching families up and prospects up to do those things. And then, like Rach said, then you secure an earlier commitment. Now we're having conversations with our committed 28s about their course selection for junior year and what their SAT plan looks like. They're like, oh, well, I'm thinking about testing in February or March next year. We're like, well, no, let's start in October so that we can start this process sooner and have more information and figure out, that piece of it.
Yeah, it's funny because we speak to thousands of players, and we run across these kids. I had a conversation just 2 weeks ago, maybe, with a young lady who was a 4.0, and her first shot at the SAT was 1130. And her parents were like, "But she's a 4.0." And I said, "Yeah, but she's below the national average on the SAT, which is 1150. Not even remotely close. Not that she's not smart enough. Maybe she just needs to take the test multiple times." And what I've noticed with kids, well, two things I've noticed with kids. One of them is that I tell people, take the SAT and the ACT. And I have noticed that some kids, left brain, right brain thing, I guess, ACT being a little more, science, math based thinking, and SAT being a little more liberal arts. Kids tend to do better on it. Figure out which one you do better on. Then you'll know which one to get help on and study for. And I've seen kids go from, I've never seen a kid go from, 1120 to 1550. I've never seen that. But I've seen kids go from 1300 to 1490s, significantly raise their scores by the third or fourth try that they've taken the test after taking classes and getting tutoring and studying, and every time you take it, you get more comfortable with the format. At least you may not know the question that's coming up, but you know the format, you know the timing, you understand how long you have for each questions, and you understand which sections you struggle with and which ones you need to study for, and that can greatly increase a player's success in getting the scores that they need to get into an Ivy League school, which leads me to my next question. What is realistic? What do kids need to target? What types of classes do they need to target specifically, like Calc BC or Calc AB, AP classes? What types of AP classes and what types of ACT scores or SAT equivalents do they need to have to be able to have a chance to get into an Ivy League school?
Oh, that's the million-dollar question, Don. I think it's going to depend on several things. So not every Ivy is the same. So I think that I can't speak for, our peers in the conference. I can speak for kind of how we navigate the process. And I think what can be challenging is that, we have families and prospects that are like, oh, well, I'm just going to take six APs in my junior year. And there's a sweet spot, and maybe we have many prospects that are capable of managing six APs while traveling every weekend for an ECNL event or whatever it is. But you want to, what we're considering in all of this is course rigor, GPA, test score. Like those are the things that are going to be touch points, data touch points. And ultimately what our admissions offices are trying to determine is like, can this particular student athlete, prospective student athlete, handle the rigor that's coming with that's associated with being a student athlete at Dartmouth? And I think, so there's not really a magic number of honors, APs. I think one thing that we tell our prospects is that our admissions office wants to see like an increase in rigor. So maybe you've had two honors classes your freshman year. Now in sophomore year, you're at maybe three honors classes and an AP class. Like, then we're going to want to see maybe three AP classes in junior year and all of that. And then, so, but we want to see that you're going to do well in those, regardless of how much more you're taking on. And then the other thing that I don't think, gets talked about a ton is where you fall relative to the rest of the students in your graduating class. So you can imagine that in the Northeast, there's a lot of applicants from this region of the country that apply to Dartmouth. So what they're trying to consider, like when we're going through this process, is like, okay, well, if we support the women's soccer prospect that's sitting in 25th in the class, and that versus, and what does that profile look like versus a top five student in, at that given high school? Like that doesn't fare well for like Dartmouth admissions, right? So it also is relative to who you're competing against within your high school. So, you know, I always use the example, like if you are a prospect that goes to some public school in wherever in the middle of somewhere, West Virginia, like what your test score being compared to those that you're graduating with is a little bit different because of the pool that you're coming from, if that makes sense.
Well, that does make sense, but how does that work? Because I mean, here's what I hear. I've heard a lot. Yeah, my daughter is 25th in her class. Yeah, but she's at a very exclusive private school, right? So she's nowhere. She's not in the top. But you know, yes, her GPA is only 3.6, and yes, she's taken a lot of AP classes, but has always gets B's in them. And but it's a hard school, right? There's a lot of homework, as opposed to I'm number one in my class at, you know, Hayward High School in Hayward, California, suburbia. Nobody's ever heard of it. And I'm number one in my class. How does that work? Does the kid who's number 25 get preferential over the kid who's number one? And how does that work?
I don't think that there's a clear-cut answer to that question of like who gets preferential. It's all just context that tells the story of that given prospect. So these are all things that we're thinking about as we recruit prospects. Like, so we, you know, we may have a prospect that's at a private school in wherever and sits at the 25 range in the class. Like, we may then ask that her test score be a bit higher because of now who she's competing against within the context of her class. So it can be a sliding scale in a lot of different ways, depending on where you're coming from, public school, private school. Like, I think that there's what you can assume from recruiting a private school prospect is that I think what they have going for them is that you know that they're taking challenging classes because that's built into their curriculum. But the downside to that is now that they're being compared to, you know, all of these other elite students that are at that private school as well. So there's good and bad to both, right? And like, and that's the that can be the thing. Like we had a prospect recently that was coming from a public high school, like, you know, in I won't say where, but it was I think 40% of the graduating class was going to a 4-year college. And our admissions office, like they're going to look at that based on the resources that are available to her at her public school, high school. They're going to say, oh, wow, like her SAT may not be as high, but look at where she is relative to her environment. And I think that's where, you know, you don't hear a lot of coaches say, well, you need this to get in, this SAT, you need this GPA, because the way that our admissions office is looking at it is like these are all data points. And the context and all of it matters as well.
And does it matter what their major is? So if they have a, oh, for like at Princeton, for example, I could think, you know, maybe physics, right? Being famous because of Einstein and all of that, you know, would be more impacted than maybe English, right? So do you think, do you think that affects how, you know, admissions works in the Ivies if a kid wants to take a soft sciences or a liberal arts major as opposed to, you know, maybe engineering or something like that, that might be a little more academically rigorous. Do you think that that affects, you know, kids' decisions and how they can get in?
From my understanding, it does at certain institutions. I can't speak to it directly, but I've heard that it does. But at Dartmouth, it doesn't. Like we, you know, our players come in sort of undecided with where they want to, you know, what they want to study, and then they can go into engineering, and they'll take the intro level classes to that, which will then set them up to walk into the engineering program. So I think we're maybe set up a little bit fortunate that way, that we're not sort of, bound to these sort of, like the professional school rigor or barriers as well. But I have heard across the league that that is something that's in place, and I think that can be a challenge. But yeah, for us, we don't run into that as often. It's more so just kind of aligning all of those contextual points to ensure that we can get a player supported through the admissions process.
And again, these are all questions that I've had come up to me, but are there majors that kids, where if a kid comes into your school and says, I'm going to take this major, you go, then you're not going to be able to play soccer if you're taking that major, because it just the classes, there's internships you're going to have to do, or there's, rotations you're going to have to do. There's things you're going to have to do that aren't going to allow you to play soccer. Are there majors like that?
Yeah, I mean, there are majors that are significantly harder than others. We allow, you can imagine that on our roster, like we have a pretty big spread across like the roster of interest of academic sort of touch points. Like we have players that have tested near perfect on the SAT and players that have tested far below that. So I think the way that we approach it is that we give the players the freedom to explore what they want to explore from an academic standpoint. I think that's one of the things that, makes Dartmouth unique in what we're offering right now, is that you get to do both things here. Like that's part of the deal. And we just, tell players like, this is going to be challenging. It's a challenging major, and we're not going to sacrifice our standards from an athletic standpoint. Like this is what you've signed up to do, and there are going to be easier pathways and not, and it's up to the individual to sort of collaborate with us, collaborate with their academic sort of support team to help ensure that they can handle that. So that's how we navigate it. We don't we see players change majors. Some of them have ideas when they walk in the door, and that very much changes. So I think, that's it's funny, like we care about what prospects are interested in and what they feel like they want to major in, but more times than not, we see that that changes by the time that
I
they
love that
have
you brought
committed.
that up,
Yeah.
Taylor. I really love that you brought that up, because it was my same experience that I'm going to say 60% of the kids that we coach change majors, maybe 70%. At
Yeah.
some point, they said, this isn't what I thought it was. It isn't what I, but I did take this class. And I think that's one of the difference. Rachel, you can kind of attest to this, but one of the differences between the American education system and the education system in much of the world is that, when you're taking business in England and that's your major, you're going to get your degree in 3 years, but you're not going to be taking English history, and you're not going to be taking social sciences, and you're not going to be taking psychology, and you're not going to be taking any of the core courses that we have to take in the United States that give us a grasp on the general education system. You're going straight into economics, and you're going straight into marketing, and you're going straight into your business classes, and they basically cut out the whole freshman year and they shove you into second semester of your sophomore year, what those classes would be immediately. So if you want to change majors in England, it means you've wasted a lot of money and time. And do you think, did you appreciate that about the American education system?
Yeah, definitely. I think funny story. I actually applied to Hertfordshire University in England before I was coming out to the US. I didn't know like that was the pathway that I was going to do. It was connected to Arsenal at the time, and so I was like, like if I want to stay at Arsenal, like this is what I need to do. And I applied and got onto a physiotherapy course there. But yeah, like that is what I would have done, and that was all I was going to learn. Like there, it wasn't going to be anything else. And then I decided, like, I'm only doing this because of the fact that I want to continue to play for Arsenal and go that pathway through there. But like, do I really want to be a
physio? Like, I'm not really sure. Like, I'm just picking this because it combines with the football side of things. So then I ended up, deciding like this is not what I want to do. Like, I have to think about this from a career standpoint. And yeah, I really appreciated it when I came out to the US, and that I think I changed my major three times. I
Wow.
thought that I wanted to be something. I really had no idea. And so it was so nice to try so many different things, especially in your freshman year, and figure out what you're interested in. And ended up studying public relations and advertising, and actually really, really enjoyed it. I would have never have known that, like prior to coming out to the US and starting my studies. But obviously took some of those communication classes and really enjoyed them. And then, figured out like this, I really enjoy this pathway. Like, let me go into this more. But yeah, like in England, like you don't get that chance. And I think it's really great that, again, like at Dartmouth, they get the opportunity to figure out what they want to do. And we've had several people on our teams that, have been in one major and then completely pivot and be something very different. I think so many of these young people go into college thinking like, oh, like this is what my parents do, so like maybe that's what I want to do.
Yes.
Is right.
Yes.
And so they're kind of living off of those interests, and then they start taking the classes and they're like, yeah, this is not what I want to do. Like, I'm not interested in, accounting or whatever it is. And
Right.
then they get to figure out and forge their own path for what makes sense for their personality and what they're interested in. And I think that's the beauty of in particular Dartmouth, and also just the education system out in the US.
That's why I'm so glad you brought that up, Taylor. I don't think we've had that discussion before, and I just think it's really important. And that's one of the values I think of the 5 and 5, giving kids an extra year. If they do get deep enough into a major and then switch and they only have 4 years of playing time, it means they're coming back to the school and now they don't have soccer. And what I think a lot of people know this, but athletes tend to have actually better GPAs across the board than the general student body does. And it's the structure. It's the structure of, yeah, when we're on the road, kids have books on the bus or on the plane. They're studying. They have, I'll notice the kids, the three of them are in the same class, then they're in a hotel room and they're studying together, for that class. And they're holding and they're talking about it. It's like, how'd you do on that test? They're kind of holding each other accountable, and it's a little, athletes are competitive, Oh, you only got that, I got this. There's a little bit of competitive nature, and it's all good. It's all good for the student. And I think that's why sports are so important as part of our educational system. And I hope it never goes away. But it could be other things too. It could be, school club events. And I think schools have known this for years, whether it's, chess club or debate or whatever, just being with other people who have similar interests to what you have outside of school or outside of just societal, interests that you might have. Having that one thing that bonds you and brings you together helps create a better student athlete.
I agree. I do think as well, just like the structure, especially for Division One level in particular, like you are busy, and so like there's not a lot of time to procrastinate. And I think that forces you to get your homework done early, to make sure you're at class, because all of those things also are part of your makeup and who you are as a person. Like all of that is getting reflected back to your coach and all of the things. So I just think the structure of being involved in our environment also positively impacts the education and the classroom side of things as well.
Well, since I brought it up, I've been asking coaches lately what they think of two different issues that have been hot topics on social media and in the news. One of them, since it's already happened, we know it's happened, and that's 5 and 5. How do you as a coaching staff, how do you guys feel about 5-5, and how has it affected your rosters? I mean, I've seen it doesn't happen on the men's side because look, the 2028 men, nobody's even thought about recruiting them yet. Not really, right? Men and women just develop at different rates, emotionally, yes, but also physically, they develop at different rates. Men are much later developers than on the women's side are. And but it's affected the women's side. I've seen 2028 coaches releasing verbal commitments from their players because, and 2027s too, for that matter, telling their 2027s, yeah, you've been committed here for a year and a half, but we're not going to recruit you anymore because we've got seniors that have decided they want to stay for 27, and it's going to happen for 28, and then hopefully coaches, I don't know. I think, is it going to slow down the recruiting process a little bit, which may not be a bad thing. I think the women's side, and I coached on the women's side for 22 years. I think we as coaches are insane that we recruit 16-year-old girls who haven't even got their driver's licenses yet, and some of them haven't started dating yet, and they haven't got their first jobs yet. And we're saying, what do you want to do for the rest of your life? What do you want to study? Where do you want to go? And this is the biggest decision you'll ever make in your life, college up to that point. And then what do you want to do? And we're recruiting them and committing them. I think it's crazy, but it's just part of the landscape. It's better than what Anson was doing years ago, which was committing 13-year-olds. So it's better than that. But I still think the guy's side has it right that they wait till the kids are, most of them are 18, and 90% of the men won't get recruited till spring of their senior year. They've got a lot more life under their belt when they're making these commitments. How do you think this 5-5 will affect the landscape in general? And then how specifically do you will it affect how you guys recruit?
I think that the way it's going to change the landscape, I think all of these things from roster limits to the transfer portal access now and the five years of eligibility, I think what it's done is that there's just less spots available year to year now because of the fact that rosters are condensed. A lot of coaches are believing in the philosophy of shopping the transfer portal rather than trying to take a first year because
True.
now this individual has experienced college soccer, maybe not in the degree of which they've wanted to, like playing time wise or whatever, right fit, how whatever you want to say, but they've at least lived in the shoes, and that could be more marketable than trying to bring in a first year. So I think there's less spots out there, and I think that's what's making it feel fast and competitive right now in the recruiting landscape. So I think that part is really fascinating. I think so from an IB perspective, we don't have roster limits. I think that so we did not opt into that, the house settlement and all of that as a conference. So we're not sitting at the 28 roster limit. However, because we are navigating in the admission support slot space, our rosters tend to be a bit smaller anyways, but we're not fighting that number year in and year out, which I think is something that is beneficial for us. I think it gives us, we're not having to make decisions about that, like every 6 months saying like, okay, let's evaluate our roster. We've got this number of class coming in. Do we have to, trim the roster at all to meet that number or whatever it is? We're not dealing with that. We're looking at like a slot limit per recruiting class. And then I think so the way that fifth year eligibility has worked at the Ivy League level in prior years, and this is across the conference, is that there's always been this assumption, well, you can't do a fifth year at an Ivy League school. And that's not true. The actual we get that assumption a lot, and we break that down. The that there's two
Where does
sort of
that come from? Where does that
we've
come
heard
from? Why
that.
would people think that?
Well, so the reason why they think it is because it's not as clear cut of a process as like a student athlete just like, having an extra year of eligibility. They didn't participate, so they get an extra year, and I'm going to do it at Dartmouth. The way that it works at an Ivy League school is that two things have to be sort of true. One, you have to remain an undergrad to pursue your fifth year of eligibility at an Ivy League institution. So you can't be a grad student. That part is real. And then the second sort of contingency to that is that there has to be, you had to have experienced some sort of hardship. It can't, you can't qualify for just a non-participatory waiver. It has to be a hardship waiver. So like an injury, like we've, COVID was one, like that was a blanket waiver across the board. So my second year as head coach in 24, we had 5 fifth years on the roster. We had five seniors that decided to delay their graduation. They had an additional year because they lost their freshman year to COVID, so they stayed. And so those two things were true. I imagine that we're going to be operating in a similar space. So it doesn't mean you automatically qualify for a fifth year. There's going to be sort of a contingency pathway in order to do that. So, like for example, at Dartmouth, we're on quarters, so we're the only Ivy League institution that's on a quarter system instead of semesters. So it's interesting, like that's why it's been a little bit more attainable for us to keep fifth years on, because now we're not asking them to like take off an entire January to May semester. We're saying take off a quarter and then delay your graduation by 2 months instead of, whatever it is. So that part has given us a little bit of flexibility in the fifth year space, which I think is has been interesting. And I think it'll continue to be interesting for us. What I'll say is that it hasn't impacted our recruiting. Like we're approaching each class individually. So like for the class of 2028, we're not thinking about what graduation, like how the fall of 2027, those seniors, how they want to approach a potential fifth year. We're still going to tackle our class of 28 from sort of like in exclusivity to what that fall of 27 roster looks like.
Well, then you can do that, like you said, because you're not limited by the 28 person
Exactly.
roster cap, where these other schools are looking at, that's my cap. That's it. Can't go over it. What do I do? So you guys are in a much better situation to operate under a business as usual
I think
than other
so.
schools
I
are.
think that's how we're approaching it right now, is business as usual. So, and it's, yeah, I think what we're living through right now is a really interesting world. And I think what Rach and I experienced as college athletes back in the 2010 sort of era, not to age us, Rach, but I think what we're doing in the Ivy space feels a lot closer to that than what this new world feels like with the transfer portal and all the things. Like, like we always get the question, like in prospects will ask us, well, how many players transfer out and how many players transfer in every year? I'm like, none transfer out. We have like a 98.9 retention rate in the country because no one's leaving Dartmouth once they get in here.
Do
So
you notice that across the Ivies in general? Do you notice a higher retention rate in the Ivies in general?
oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Makes
And I think
sense.
then, and then like, then it becomes this really interesting conversation around culture. Like, I think that's one of the biggest uniqueness, sort of like unique aspects of our environment at Dartmouth right now, is that we have this really fun and special team culture that we've spent a lot of time developing. And I think that takes time and it takes continuity and it takes some consistency in the players that make it up. Like obviously you're going to graduate players every year, but like for that 3 years at a time, you've got a core that's working together. And so I think going back to my statement of like what we lived through back in the 2010 sort of era of like you sign up to be a part of something for 4 years, like that's the space that we're living in right now in the Ivy League, at Dartmouth, where we get to say, yeah, like come here. This is a 4 year development model. Like this is a 4 year commitment plan. And we're gonna work together to like see you through these, you're like attaining this prestigious degree, developing as a player. Like, do you want to be a pro soccer player? Great, come here, come to Dartmouth. We can help you do that. We've seen that pathway done at a place like this without having to sacrifice your education alongside of it.
Yeah, I love that. And you say, you're in your third year now at Dartmouth, right?
Walking into fall number four.
Number four. So I've always say, I always said as a coach, and I said this in every interview that I ever, when I interviewed for a job, it's like, all you will know by year three whether I'm going to make it any farther or not. But it takes 5 years to really build my program. Because, you know, when you bring in, you come in, and those sophomores now that you didn't recruit have been, I always said infected, but they've been infected or affected by juniors and seniors and sophomores before them that you didn't recruit, that you didn't train, that you didn't have anything to do with. And we're going to need the seniors to graduate and then the juniors to graduate. And every class gets a little less infected with the philosophy of the prior coach, assuming the program wasn't successful, right? Assuming there were struggles in the program. Obviously, if you took over a five-time national champion, they probably didn't have a lot of worries, but most of us don't get the luxury of taking over a five-time national champion. So, you know, it just takes time, and it
It
does
does.
take 5 years to say, finally, we are clean of all of the preconceived notions about why they came here, or what training is about, or, you know, how to get through hard times. All of the kids now are they're our kids, all of them. You know, not that the other kids aren't your kids, but you know what I mean, right? And I always said it takes 5 years.
We treat them all as they are ours because they are, but I think it's just, you know, you change, we're trained in the standards. Like that's what it's been about. And, you know, we are bringing, we've changed our recruiting philosophy. It's not about, you know, finding the players that wanna, you know, oh, they want to come to Dartmouth and they also happen to play soccer. Like we're going after players that are big time soccer players that don't know they want to come to Dartmouth yet. Like that's the mission. And I
Right.
think if we can continue to do that, it's like, you know, that's, and that's where like, you know, Rach's point, like the international piece has been so interesting because we've attracted some top international talent over the last couple of years and couple recruiting cycles. And it's like, no, they're like figuring out where they can play soccer. And then if the school is great, then that just happens to be a bonus. And that's kind of like how it's gone with a few of our internationals, which has been funny, but great. But yeah, it's definitely taking time. We're getting there. Obviously, like we had a great year last year and you're starting to see the tides shift. And, but yeah, I mean, we had this program was in a championship drought for about 22 years. So it was a special year last year. And I think it happened maybe faster than we thought, but I think you know, you get the right staff with the right group of players. It's really special. And I always say that the best recruit I've ever gotten to Dartmouth is Rachel Pittman, because to take her away from her alma mater was one of my best, the best recruiting pitch of my entire career. So it's been a lot of fun to do together.
It does. It look, it's, I don't know, Rachel, you're in a very cool place. I had more fun as an assistant coach than I did as a head coach, to be honest. I really, and Taylor, you've been an assistant too. Maybe you don't speak at all on this one, Taylor, because you're in your position, but I had more fun definitely as an assistant coach. It just, being a head coach just has so much of the job that has nothing to do with soccer associated with it, and you know, just so much administrative stuff that it kind of takes away from being able to do the soccer piece, and that sometimes then falls to the assistant, right? To do some more of the soccer stuff. Then what do you think? Are you having a good time there, Rachel?
I'm having a great time. I think also the head coach always turns out to be the bad guy, right? Like
Have to be, right. Players are way more scared of the head coach than they are of the assistant. 100%.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, Taylor's pretty nice, but yeah, you know, I think it does always fall on the head coach, the decisions of the starting lineup and why players aren't playing, even though it's very much a collective, like it's always going to fall back on Taylor. And yeah, we always, the assistants is we're the nice ones. But you know, like we very much contribute to the decision making as well. It just falls on Taylor, unfortunately.
Yeah, I don't
No
know. Do you
comment.
want to say something,
No,
Taylor? You
I'm just
guys are both
teasing.
laughing. I can tell there's internal
Yeah.
stuff that's inside jokes
Oh,
that are
it's
going through
fun.
both your heads at the same time, and
Well, it's funny, like anything that like the players experience that is like really taxing or really like traumatic for them, we'll use that word, like they always assume it's my idea. And I'm like, I don't know why you guys think that this has come from me, because usually I think it comes from Rachel. So, but somehow, like, they just assume it comes from my brain. But yeah, Rach is definitely the favorite on staff, which she deserves it. She's yeah, the players adore her, and she's had such a huge impact in our environment. So we have a lot of fun. I'll tell you what, I feel really lucky every day, and there's been a lot of ups and downs over these first 3.5 years. You know, I mean, in 2024, like, you know, I took over the program in December of 22, and you know, I took over a program that was sort of living in the bottom half of the Ivy League for the better part of a decade. And in 24, we finished in, that was Rach's first year, after this big recruiting pitch to get her to come and join me and what we're going to build together and all the things. And then we finished in 8th place, 8 of 8, which was a miserable year. But I mean, it wasn't like it was, you know, we were just turning the tides
Oh, it
and bringing
was
the group
too. Stop
together.
it.
It was
It's
miserable.
miserable.
It
It's
was a long off season.
miserable.
It
Losing
was
is not.
miserable.
Winning is like a lot more fun than losing. It's a lot more
I'll tell
fun.
you what, I'm a terrible loser. It's a
Me
toxic trait of
too.
mine. I'm a terrible loser. And so then fast forward, 25 happens, and we win the championship, and it's been so fun. Like, it's come with a lot of challenges, a lot of like learning moments. But I think when you get your staff right, and you get the culture right in the team, and you're starting to bring in the right kids that are sort of aligned in personality and goals and ambition and energy, like, that was probably one of the biggest lessons I've learned as a head coach, being from being an assistant, was like, your team like mirrors your energy. So whatever you decide to be on the day, that's what you're going to get from them. So it's just taken time for that sort of energy and vibe to shift. And now it feels like we got a pretty good thing going, and hopefully we can keep it rolling.
That's that's really astute, but you've been a coach for a long time, so I'm not surprised. But that's a really good message for younger coaches starting out, because there are days when you need to walk into the locker room with like, hey, just relax. It's just another game. This is not a big deal. And everything needs to be super calm. And there's another days when you need to come in bouncing off the walls. Because that's what they're going to need that day. You felt it in training, you know your opponent, you studied enough film, you know what energy the game's going to bring. Do we need to just relax and control the ball today? Or do we need to press and counter today? Or do we need to just low block it and just relax today? And you know, what are we bringing? And then also, you need to know your team really well and listen to your captains and hear what the vibe of the women are, you know, or the guys that I'm coaching, what the vibe is with the team. And you need that teamwork between the coaching staff and the captains to help rein the team and guide them the right direction. But it varies depending on what part of the season you're playing in and who your opponent is. That's just a really good point. I'm glad you brought that up.
And it's like, you know, if you can really get it right, then you figure out, then you build out the right staff. Like, I think Rach and I laugh about this all the time. Like, we're wired the same. Like, we think about things really similarly, but we like carry it out so differently. Like, she always says, like, my head's in the clouds and her feet are on the ground. Like, that's sort of the balance. Like, I'm like this person that thinks that, like, you know, I wake up and it's a great day every day, and we're gonna accomplish everything that imaginable. And she's like, all right, well, it's probably a little bit more realistic if we tackle these three things at a time. So we calm down over there, and like, and then
What?
that
A
shows up.
pragmatic Englishman? How does that work?
I
I
say
didn't
that
know
all
the
the time.
English were
It's my
pragmatic. I had
culture.
no
It's my
idea.
culture.
100%. And it's the pro culture too, right? It's the coach that you played for, you know, one of the greatest coaches in the women's game. And the success that the Arsenal women have had, I don't know how many. I'm an Arsenal fan, so you know, I've you, naturally just it just information about the Arsenal women just comes through into the zeitgeist of an Arsenal fan, and it's one of the most successful, you know, women's pro teams in the country. And what lessons have you been able to directly translate, Rachel, over to the pro game, because there aren't very many coaches. Maybe you're the only one. I don't know. Not very many coaches in the country that have experienced that high of a level of women's soccer and being around Arsenal and the men's team, and one of the most, top 10 talked about teams in the world for many, many years now, and being in that environment. How has that translated into your coaching and what you're able to relate to the women's side? Because I think it's unique, right?
I think I actually have been really fortunate that I've been coached by some of the top female coaches in the world. Laura Harvey was also my coach. So just those two names there, in addition to several other, incredible female coaches that I've had. But I think especially with those two coaches in particular, what I've learned and kind of what's rubbed off on me is like just the understanding of the players. I think like the relationships built. Like I think both Emma and Laura Harvey are very similar in that aspect. Like they have really good relationships with their players. They know their players inside out. They understand like what those players need at any given moment. Like that is kind of what makes them so great is their emotional intelligence and understanding of their players is of the highest level. And so I think I take a lot of that. Like I think I try to understand the players that I work with because I know that, myself as a player, like there are days when you might need an arm around your shoulder. There are other days where you might need to kick up the bum, right? Like that's kind of your coach needs to understand like where you're at. And so I think like being in different environments at the pro level, being at Arsenal like that under really good coaches, like that's what I've taken and really emphasized within my coaching game. We can all grow in terms of our tactical understanding and what sessions we put on, right? But like if your players don't feel that you care about them and like you understand them, like there's a level to what you're going to get out of them. And I think like making them really, really great is that extra 5%. And it's about understanding what they need, how they need to be coached, and also just getting to know them on a daily basis so that they feel that you have their best interests at heart.
I love that, and I know you're right. And that's I just was sucked at it. I was terrible at it. That's why I always had to have an assistant or a head coach or whatever that was better at all of that, because I wanted none of it. I just wanted the X's and O's it to pieces, and I just wanted to teach the game and then let me go home and leave me alone. I was so bad at that piece, and I think a lot of coaches are, honestly. Women's coaches, men's coaches. Women that are, coaching in the women's game, I don't think it automatically makes them good at that piece just because they're a woman. And yet I know a lot of male coaches, friends of mine coaching women that do a great job of it. And ironically, I mean, I just did an interview a few months ago now with Jamie Clark at University of Washington, national champions. He understands that, and his dad understood that, the great Bobby Clark, who coached at Dartmouth,
Yes, he did.
understood that very well, very, very well. And even like Arsene Wenger understood that very, very well at Arsenal. And Tony Adams will say he saved my life and extended my career because he cared about me. And so I don't think it's necessarily a men's and a women's thing, although I do think that on the women's side, if you don't have that understanding, you've got almost a zero chance of success. And on the men's side, you can still be successful to an extent, if you don't have that empathetic piece of the puzzle and emotional understanding, emotional intelligence rather, piece of the puzzle, that you can have a little more success on the men's side. On the women's
I think
side,
it's
it's almost zero.
I also think it's fascinating, like we've talked about it a lot, Rach, like just how much it's changed in the last decade based on this new generation of like student athlete. Like,
Oh,
the
yes.
just like how much say they have. Like we grew up in the era of like you follow your coach blindly. You don't ask why. You just put your
100%.
head down and you work. And now like the first thing that we're met with from our players is, well, why? Like, why are we doing this? Why does this matter? Why is this important? And
Yeah.
if you're not willing to like invite them into that conversation, then you're gonna have a hard time, you know, cultivating buy-in. And I think that's something that I have certainly learned over my decade of coaching. Like the way I coached when I was 23, 24 is a lot different now at 34 because of just how this new wave of you know, generational shift has sort of impacted, you know, our environments.
Well, Taylor, there's two pieces to that. Number one, yes, the players are expectations are different. And the other thing is, and you will notice over the next 10 years of your career and the 10 years past that, it's your maturity too.
Yeah, that's definitely, I
You've
definitely agree
matured
with
and
that.
changed. When
That's
I
for
was in
sure.
my 30s and players came back 15 years later and watched me coach, they go, "Who are you? You're a completely different person. Why are you so calm? You are not that way with us." And it's like, well, yeah, because I don't have I don't have that energy, man, that I had when in my 30s, that when I was in my 50s. I just don't have it.
You also
You're
get
right.
softer as well, I think. Like I always think about my head coach, Erin Chastain at DePaul. She's at Minnesota now, and like, you know, when we were there and years prior to me, like she was so tough. And then when I went back and coached her, I'm like, you're so soft now. Like,
There you
and she's
go.
like, no, we're training too hard. And I'm like, who are you? We were doing terrible Tuesdays after a game of Friday, Sunday. Like,
Right.
yeah.
Right. And if three players didn't throw up, you weren't stopping. So somebody was going to
Yeah.
throw up today. Yeah.
I'm like, I hear all this about load management. I said, no one worried about our load management back in the
Oh no. We didn't. We never heard the word load management. What are you talking about? Yeah.
Yeah.
No, it's so true how it's all changed. Well, the last topic, and I'm just curious what you guys think about it, that I wanted to make sure that I hit, and that's the talk of the 2-semester model. There are women's coaches who want it. I interviewed Randy Waldrum at Pitt and Ben and I've talked to other coaches too, and then I've talked to G. At when he's at Texas, and he's talking about not wanting it. It's a back and forth issue, and I'd say most men's coaches want it, and maybe someday men will get it. I don't know, but it's been a hot topic. What do you think of the 2-semester model?
What do you think, Rach?
I always think back to what we experienced in COVID and kind of after that. And especially like I was in the Midwest at the time, right, in Chicago, and how hard that was. We were, you know, busing out to a dome that was like an hour and a half away. You know, you're starting your journey at like 5 a.m. in the morning to go out and train before they have class. And like that's what it would be, right? Like, because you're gonna be, you know, especially in those places where
Well,
it's
we're in
snowy and it's
California over
cold.
here, so we wouldn't be that
Yeah,
way in California or Florida. We don't
right.
care.
You wouldn't have to worry about that, right? But like, that's the reality of it is
Yeah.
that, like, you know, not every school has the ability to go to an indoor venue that's like on campus. So then you have to go outside of that, and what does that look like? And financially, how does that work? Because that comes at a cost. Like these domes are expensive. And I just don't think that, again, like you always have to think, does it put the student athlete experience and health and wellness at the forefront? Like, I don't think that does. Personally, yes, I, you know, like you talk about like the class schedules and not missing as many classes when it's all crammed in, and how hard it is on the body when you're, you know, playing Thursday, Sunday or whatever that is, and spreading it out would be better. But like also there is then the flip side of that is you're going to be going super in the morning, super early in the morning to these domes for some places. And how does that impact
them. Like, this is something that they're going to be dealing with, the season of stress all year round, versus like it just compact into the fall season. And you know, you're probably like, from a career standpoint, internships are potentially out the window. Like, especially for us, like our girls are doing them, you know, not just in the summer. Like, there's other times a year that they're doing them as well. You know, maybe spring break or March sort of time. So yeah, I just think it sounds nice, but the reality, I think it would be a real challenge.
Well, I mean, we can all admit from a f just purely soccer developmental standpoint, it's the right thing to do, right? Just from that. But unfortunately, we're dealing with a lot more than just soccer players in college. And I can see both sides of it. I really can. I can hear the argument, you know, and Randy talked about if we really cared about our student athletes, we shouldn't be jamming, you know, 29 games into 12 weeks, and you know we shouldn't be pulling them out of class so much, and you know we should have our games on the weekends so they don't miss any class times, and you know we should be spreading it out. Okay, I hear you. On the other side of it is exactly what you're talking about. For this really depends on whose lenses you're looking at through, right? Some of us have sunglasses on, some of us have glasses like mine, some of us don't need glasses at all. Depends on what whose lenses you're looking at it through, because in the Ivy and through much of the country, it's not just the Ivy. Internships are a very big part of it. I had one of my players who played at Stanford, and she was able to take a semester abroad during the spring, and Stanford allowed her to do that and then come back to the team in the fall like nothing happened. It wasn't upset about it. Good luck trying that at a Power Four school that's, you know, top five in the country competing for a national championship. And tell me what the coach thinks about that. The coach isn't going to tolerate it. It's not even an option. So you're right. It would eliminate a lot of that. It would eliminate internships. It would eliminate a lot of the student athlete experience for a large percentage of student athletes in the country. And every poll that I've seen on the women's side is that the players themselves do not want this.
And
Stop
a lot of
forcing it on us. They don't want it.
I've seen from a lot of the coach data too that the majority of coaches don't want it either. And I appreciate, you know, Rach's pragmatic and logical sort of rationale behind it. I always tend to go to like the emotional social side of it, and I'm like thinking about the meaningful games spread out across 9 months or 10 months. Like, the Final Four is in December. Like, that is, I don't know, like, to think about stretching that out from like August or September across, like, it just changes the whole dynamic of what college soccer is. And that to me is like, I don't know. Like, I know that we have to continue to evolve, and I understand that from a sports science perspective and a development perspective, there's a lot of benefit. But you know, and then I think about too, like, you know, I think about from like, you know, there's been a lot of professional sports that have expanded their seasons, and how much that's diluted like the fan base and just the excitement around it, because now there's more games, which means more of them are meaningless versus the ones that are remain meaningful and all the things. So it's really interesting to think about, but I think right now as it stands, like I would be, I don't know, more inclined to want to leave it in this format. I think, you know, you can see with the transition period, the acclimation period and all of that, they're trying to figure out ways to like prioritize the periodization of it all, but I don't know. I think the two season thing is interesting. I
Yeah,
also
you know, I
think that,
go ahead. Go ahead. Yeah.
sorry, this is like my
That's
biggest
okay.
thing, is that I think it will break if it were to happen. Like, you're financially sound, your Power Fours, and not even all of them, but like those that have the financials and the budgets to be able to do that will break away from everybody else. And is that really what we're trying to achieve here? Like, I don't think so. And so, like, I also see it from that lens, and I'm like, well, let's try and preserve what we have here, because I do think it's incredible. Like, I came from somewhere that didn't have this, and like our fall season, it's so exciting. It's so fun to be a part of. So again, like if you're
Excuse me.
splitting that up and suddenly like it's just your Power Fours that are doing that and the ones that can afford it, like what does that turn into?
No, I think you're right. I mean, I whenever this topic comes up and people ask me what I think, which is very rarely because nobody cares, but when people do ask me what I think, it's I know administrators way too well. And administrators do not like any idea of stretching resources any farther than what they are. In fact, they're usually looking to contract whenever possible, not expand resources. So I don't think administrators are going to approve this, with the exception, I think the first place this could happen is in American football and in men's basketball, possibly women's basketball, if we see the SEC break away, which is it's been all over the news again. It's starting to creep back into the zeitgeist, where American football coaches are screaming, "We do not need the NCAA. They're holding us back. We need to pull away. Then we can just keep all the money for ourselves, and it will give us greater resources to do what we want to do and be who we want to be, which is a developmental league for the NFL. That's what our goal is." And if they break away and then basketball breaks away, well, that will break the NCAA. The NCAA will be essentially bankrupt at that point. There'll have to be a reorganization, and then maybe you see some of the soccer teams on the men's side break away as an experimental group. And then does women's soccer follow? Doesn't have to. I mean, we already see a lot of rules that are different in women's soccer as opposed to men's soccer, dead periods and recruiting guidelines and the acclimatization period that women's soccer has gone through, which is something that you and I were talking about, Rachel. The Ivy League doesn't do that. You guys are what, going to be 20 days behind, something like that?
We'll
The rest
be
of the country, Division
yeah.
One?
Yeah, we'll be 2 additional weeks behind everybody that's starting on the day one of the acclimatization period. What I've heard is that a lot of mid-major conferences are sticking with the traditional preseason date, which we're then a week behind. So
Okay.
it's, yeah, that's where the Ivy League stands. They always have. They've just been 1 week behind, which is an interesting take, but I think it's rooted in summer internships and the things that some of the things that we've talked about, like that holistic sort of educational experience of our student athletes. But yeah, I'm sure that the with this new transition period that started, we'll have to at least acknowledge it as a conference. I know that head coaches are talking about it. Sport administrators, ADs are talking about how do we want to approach this? We usually lag behind by about a year or two when we fig try to figure out, okay, like what's this going to look like for us? So I'm sure that you'll see us take a stance on it here, within the next 6 months to 6 to 12 months.
It's going to be a tough conversation between exactly what you talked about. Kids that are in internships, summer internships, they go to a certain date. And then also fairness, though, from a team standpoint, fairness. And it's like, well, if you're going to put us behind, and I guess as long as presidents and athletic directors don't have unrealistic expectations, because it does put you at a competitive disadvantage to be behind. That's just a reality of it, right? At least on a national level, not within the Ivy Leagues per se. And then on the third hand, if you can have one, look, the whole goal is to be rocking and rolling by the time you win your conference title and go into the NCAA anyways. That's the whole goal. And at that point, that extra week didn't matter for squat. If you can really get it rocking and rolling in the Ivies, and maybe you lost a game or two preseason that you didn't want to lose, but in the long run of things, it's not going to matter if you can win your first round game and get into of the NCAAs and get into the mix of it with you got to beat everybody anyways phase of the tournament, right?
Yeah, that's the kind of the take we look at. Like, it's 2 weeks, it's 3 weeks, whatever you want to say. It's a week, depending on who you're looking at, but we always laugh too, like, our whole staff, we went through the college system, we've played. Like, we can remember the days where, like, you never, after day one of preseason, like, you never feel as good again until, like, Christmas break. So we're like, oh well, at least it's 2 or 3 weeks longer that our players feel fresh. So maybe we'll just roll with that and see how it takes it, see how it goes.
No, that there is something to that. That's not an unreal thing. That is very true. Well, anything else you want to leave us with?
Right? I
Any
don't think
other
so.
parting thoughts? Any projects you guys are working on? Any promotion projects or
No.
things you have going?
Just trying to win another Ivy championship, Don. That's
Right on.
the number one project these next few months. So go big green. Hopefully we've made a Dartmouth women's soccer fan out of you.
I love it, guys. Well, thanks for coming on. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having us. We
Thanks so
appreciated it.
much.